Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Dalton of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today I talk to Ed Butts, who's a local historian and author whose works include Running with Dillinger, True Canadian Unsolved Mysteries, and The Desperate Ones, Forgotten Canadian Outlaws. But on the eve of Remembrance Day next week, the topic I talk to Butts about today is Guelph's War Dead, a topic he's been researching exhaustively for the last 3 years. Remembering Guelphites that died in the Great War is the topic of the Guelph Politicast this week, but first, my usual public service announcement. Guelph Politico is crowdfunded through Patreon, where you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable using PayPal or your credit card, and all that money goes to maintaining a locally sourced independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you'll be paying to keep the Politicast going, as well as regular coverage of city council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. For more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. And now on with the show. The Guelph Cenotaph stands as a stark reminder of all those that died on behalf of their country in World War I, World War II, and the Korean War. But while we recognize the collective effort, remembering the war dead as a single body every November 11th, what about the names on the cenotaph as individuals? What were their lives like before they joined the military and were shipped overseas? How did they live? How did they die? And what or who did they leave behind? These are questions that occurred to Ed Butts, an author of numerous books about true crime, unsolved mysteries, and local history. Looking at the cenotaph, he saw not just hundreds of names, but hundreds of stories, and in 2014, the commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, he approached the Guelph Mercury about a series of profiles of those engraved on the cenotaph in memoriam. Since then, Butts is still only part of a way through that journey, but in the process has made some fairly interesting discoveries, some of which he shares on this week's Guelph Politicast. There are cases of mistaken identity, trying to do historical research when you're given typos, names that should be on the cenotaph but aren't, and the people that actually came home but were unable to leave the war behind. They're powerful and fascinating stories, and the reason we remember on Remembrance Day. So I caught up with Ed Butts, local historian and author, earlier this week in studio. So Ed Butts, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Why were you drawn to the cenotaph? I mean, it's a very important memorial in the city, but I feel like where it is placed on the corner of Woolwich and Wyndham, it's someplace that I think probably tens of thousands of people pass by every day. And perhaps there's only one day out of the year where people kind of stop and notice it. I mean, is that your feeling too, and maybe why you're drawn to it?
Well, yeah, that's pretty much it. In fact, I got started with this in 2014, which was the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the First World War. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the cenotaph, and I realized that the only name on there that most people would recognize is that of John McCrae, mm-hmm. because of the poem.
Right.
And I thought that Every single one of all those other names represents a person, somebody who had their own story, but aside perhaps from family members who might still be in Guelph, nobody knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So I spoke to Phil Andrews at the Mercury and suggested maybe a few articles about some of the names on the cenotaph. I would do some research and see what I could find out. And he was interested, and what began as, you know, what was going to be a few articles became more than 50 articles, and I was still working on it when, unfortunately, the Mercury closed down.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have nonetheless been continuing with the research on all of those names, because I possibly will be doing a book about Guelph during the First World War.
Mm-hmm. So you said you got through about maybe 50 names, which as it turns out is a quarter of the way.
Yeah, that's 50 articles. Some of the articles involve more than one name.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really say how many names that I got. I never actually counted them.
Mm.
But there are still some other names that I haven't really been able to get at yet.
The point about John McCrae is a good one, because that's a bit of Guelph history that does live beyond Guelph. Every school kid across the country knows that poem, or at least they do on November the 11th. That's a good sort of place to build from in terms of our local history, because it does have that national recognition. I wonder, from your perspective, does Guelph kind of have maybe a better handle on the impact of World War One, just because we have that, it's internationally recognized too. There's that internationally recognized connection that stanza that encapsulates everything that war was about.
We do point to John McCrae as one of Guelph's sons. I mean, many other communities will have individuals from that war. Owen Sound, for example, has Billy Bishop.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I have found is that there are so many fascinating stories behind that list of names. I'm just right now speaking for the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
That even I can do a book without even having to touch on Colonel John McCrae.
Mm-hmm.
One of the names is John Playford Hales, who came from a prominent Guelph family.
Mm-hmm.
He became a fighter pilot. He's one of a handful of those names on that cenotaph who were airmen. And he actually managed to achieve the status of ace. If you shot down 5 enemy planes,
mm-hmm.
you got to call yourself an ace. And he did achieve that before he finally was himself killed in combat. He was shot down by anti-aircraft fire.
Uh-huh. And I think we underestimate or perhaps don't understand how difficult that would have been. And, you know, when World War One started, that was 5 years after first plane left the ground. That this wasn't just a new form of warfare. It was almost like an experiment in terms of how these machines could operate in a practical way.
Oh, yeah. And in the course of research, you get to read some of the letters that were written home by those people. And there are a couple of letters in which they talk about just how tricky those things were to fly. I mean, there were probably as many young men were killed or injured in training as were shot down.
Yeah. They weren't all Red Barons.
No.
Well, let's talk about some of those names. We've mentioned one, and I'm sure, other than Colonel John McCrae, of course, I do think, you know, one of the things I did growing up was when I was in high school, the church I went to, we had a Remembrance Day portion of the service, you know, on or around November 11th. And one of the things we did one year is me and my best friend, because we had met in the church Sunday school and we'd been friends for 15 years, and we were sort of chosen to take wreaths up and lay wreaths down. And it was kind of symbolic because of how many people went to war, and maybe only one of them came home or none of them came home. And you know, and that, when I think about Remembrance Day, that's kind of always in the back of my mind, that sort of image of, you know, you go somewhere with someone who meant so much to you and one of you doesn't come home. And I'm very interested in hearing some of these stories too. And, you know, you have a couple of names written down here, so.
Yeah.
Well, I'll turn it over to you,
okay.
The expert.
Well, there's, for the First World War, there are 220 names listed on the Guelph Cenotaph.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider that at the time of the First World War, Guelph was a community of approximately 15,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of names.
Yeah.
And those were the ones who were killed. And by the way, There were a number of people from Guelph who were killed whose names didn't get on the cenotaph for one reason or another.
Right.
But one that I'd like to start with is the only woman who's listed with the 220 for the First World War is Alice Trusdale, and she was a nurse. Now, she was originally from Walkerton, but she trained at the Guelph General Hospital, and she went overseas to serve with the nursing sisters. And I mean, those people, even however well trained they might have been in Canada, they simply were not prepared for the carnage that they witnessed, for the absolute slaughter. And medical supplies were in short supply. There was no such thing as an anesthetic. I mean, ether was invented, but it was in short supply. and there were no antibiotics, and very often there wasn't much more that a nurse could do for a wounded man besides hold his hand while he died. And Alice came back home from the war, and she was serving. There was a hospital that was set up over near Kitchener that was treating sick and wounded soldiers who had come back. A lot of men came back with meningitis, which they called trench fever. The Spanish flu epidemic was going on, and she was treating soldiers over there, and she fell ill herself from her exposure to sick men, and she was brought to the Guelph General Hospital, where she died. And one of the unfortunate things is that her name is spelled incorrectly on the cenotaph. Her name was Trusdale, and the name on the cenotaph is Trudale. And I found that was true of several people whose names were misspelled.
Typos.
Typos, permanent typos.
But that was kind of, I was reading some of your articles. Was that part of this project initially, or was that something that came organically, like, you know, finding the typos, finding the errors, finding the omissions?
That was something that just happened. When I began the research, I found that there were some names I was having a really hard time tracking anything down. And then I would find a name somewhere else, and I would realize, oh, that's this person on the list, and that name on the cenotaph is misspelled. That's why I'm having a hard time finding anything.
Right.
And then, with the corrected name, I could go into the research, and up came the documents.
I think maybe some young people today might not understand the difficulties in this kind of research, like the before computers looking into things, because I think we're used to, if you have a misspelled name, like Google will still give you, do you mean this person? That is probably not helpful to you when you're trying to connect names on this monument, some of which may be misspelled, to records that have that person's properly spelled name.
Yeah, well, having correct spelling certainly is a boon. One of the things that has been a great help to me is that Library and Archives Canada has a website that is called Soldiers of the First World War, which has, you can access them online, the attestation papers of just about every Canadian who enlisted in the Canadian Expeditionary Force. And attestation papers, those are the papers that the soldier went and filled out and signed when he enlisted. So you can get that up on your computer screen, and you can make a print of it. And there, like, you can see the person's signature in his very own handwriting, where he swore to do his duty for King George V. And the one thing that always strikes me is when I look at that attestation paper and I see the young man's signature on it, and I can't help but wonder if he really knew what he was letting himself in for. Because life at the front was hell.
Yeah.
I mean, they certainly did have downtime when they could go and spend a bit of time in a French village and enjoy the company of their comrades and that. But when it came time for the battle, I don't think people today in their wildest dreams can imagine how horrible it was.
That's one of the sort of lessons of that war, was that a lot of people went in June 1914, thought they'd be home by Christmas.
Yeah, and you find that in the papers too. They were sure that they were going to be home by Christmas and that this war couldn't last more than a year, and mm-hmm. of course it was 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So that's Alice Truesdale. That's her proper name, Alice Truesdale.
Alice Truesdale.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I've found really interesting has been the opportunity to meet family members of some of those men.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they might be a grandson or a grandniece or whatever. One of the men was Walter Hayward,
mm-hmm.
A lady who is, I believe she's his niece, came over to my house to talk to me about her uncle. She had a box, was about the size of a shoebox, and on the side of it, it said 1918, and there was a regimental number, and that was the actual box that his personal effects were sent home in.
Wow.
After he had been killed in battle. And she opened it up, and inside there were some documents and a few photographs, and there was a leather pouch, a sort of soft suede-type material, and it had been ripped.
Mm-hmm.
And inside there were fragments of photographs. They had also been ripped up. He had this on his person when he was killed by shrapnel. He was killed because of an exploding shell. And it looks like it must have been a piece of shrapnel ripped across this pouch and shredded up the photographs that were inside. They were like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle.
Wow.
So that was put in the box in 1918 and sent home to his family, and this lady still had it, and she gave it to me to look at, and I just thought, now, this was what the guy actually had on him at the moment that he was killed.
Yeah.
I thought, that is just amazing. And you could hardly have more, say, feeling of reverence for something.
Yeah.
Because this was the moment that he died, and that's why it was torn up from a piece of shrapnel.
Yeah.
And she also had photographs of him. So I got to see, you know, who the person was who this artifact had belonged to.
Yeah, it's powerful. It's almost like it takes you back there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt privileged that she brought that along to show me.
Had nobody opened this box since it was
yes. It had been opened. It, okay. And it had been in her family for many years. I mean, since 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to share that with me, and she was she also asked me what she might do with it, because she didn't know who she should leave it to, or if somebody else would, you know, cause it to be lost. And I thought, well, maybe take it over to the Colonel John McRae Museum, or up to the Guelph Museum.
Yeah,
I bet you they'd like it.
Oh, absolutely. It does speak to perhaps the mind of the family too, when they get this box. They kept the box, the contents in it, you know, everything that was kind of sent home with them. It speaks to their mindset, perhaps, perhaps their shock, and, you know, keeping it all in this box, separate sort of from everything else that was part of his life, speaks to their reaction.
Yeah, at that, you know, there was a man who went away, and
that's
all that came back.
Yeah. Anyway, let's continue
now,
on.
One other interesting story is a young man named Bernard Pantel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he and his sister emigrated to Canada from England, and they were actually living in London when Bernard, even before the war broke out, he decided to join the army. So he was already in the Canadian army when the First World War started.
Mm-hmm.
He was sent overseas, and he was wounded in action, and the army decided that he was no longer fit for service, so they discharged him and sent him home. Now, by that time, his sister had married and was living in Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
So he arrived back here, and he decided that the army was wrong, that he was still fit for service, and he wanted to get back into the war. But since he had been discharged, he couldn't sign up again.
Mm-hmm.
However, he had a cousin who did not want to go to the war, so the cousin lent him his identification papers. But the name was George Simmons.
Right.
So Bernard Pantel went and enlisted again as George Simmons. He went back over to France to fight. He was killed in the Battle of Vimy Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
The notice, they were usually informed by telegram. The telegram arrived back here that George Simmons had been killed in action. Well, George Simmons was still sitting there very much alive. And that's where the ruse was found out, that in fact Bernard Pantel had gone into the army again under another name. And curiously enough, he is buried in France under both names.
Really?
Yep, his marker has two names on it.
Pantel, a.k.a. George Simmons, or
something like that. Yes, yeah. Now, there is one person whose name did not get on the cenotaph.
Yeah.
There was a young man named Frederick Willis, who was a ward of the Ontario Children's Aid,
mm-hmm.
of their office here in Guelph. And he had been sent out to live with a farmer, and when he decided to join the army when the war started, he gave the farmer's name as next of kin.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed in action, and by that time, the farmer to whom he had been attached had died. So the notice of his death was sent to the Ontario Children's Aid office in Guelph.
Right.
And that was about as far as it got. And when the time came to start gathering up names to put on the cenotaph, because he was an orphan, he had no family here to submit his name, so he was one of the ones who didn't get his name on the cenotaph.
Hmm.
And the only reason I knew about it was when I was going through the archives of the Mercury, I found a very small notice that mentioned him in a group of Guelph men who had been killed in a battle. And that was the very sketchy information about him, was that he had been a ward of the Ontario Children's Aid.
Wow. Is that how the names on the cenotaph were put together, was that it was families?
I think so, because there is one name, now I can't remember it off the top of my head. It was a family that had come to Canada from Britain, and the mother and one of the sons came and lived in Guelph, but there was another son who never set foot in Guelph. He went to Calgary, and he enlisted out west, and he went overseas, and he was killed in action, but his mother was in Guelph, and I guess it must have been through her that his name was on the Guelph cenotaph. He had family here, though he never actually lived in Guelph.
Interesting. Because I imagine, again, I'm not knowing, but perhaps there was some sort of notice in the Mercury that, you know, we're putting this together, this memorial, if you have a family member or loved one who, you know, died in action during the war, we're looking to gather names, something like that.
Yeah, I think that must have been the case. The war memorial didn't go up until, I believe it was 1924.
Hmm. Interesting. Of course, War Memorial Hall here on campus, another sort of artifact of people looking to memorialize what happened and the people who died in the war.
Yeah, and there are honor lists in some of the churches. There's the one in GCVI.
Mm-hmm. I am curious about revisiting Walter Pantel. Or Walter Pantel and the George Simmons thing. What happened? Do you know what happened to George Simmons for not?
I have not been able to find anything. I mean, I'm sure he must have been in trouble.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to find any report on it.
I find the story interesting because I think we kind of identify what was going on in his head. It's sort of a more modern phenomenon. We see that in a lot of Afghanistan war, Iraq war veterans who come home and don't quite know what to do with themselves. And so the thing that they know is war, so they go back to that. I wonder if something similar was going on in Pantel's head that, you know, I don't know. I was in this horrible place, but I knew what I had to do. Now I'm here. I have to get back there because that's what I know and that's what I've come to acclimate to.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, he might have just been a warrior at heart or had a real tremendous sense of duty.
Mm-hmm.
I came across the story of another young man. Now, this person is not on the on the cenotaph because he was not killed in action, but young man named, his last name was Callender. When the war started, he went straight down to enlist, and he was underage, and he was also too small.
Mm.
Among other things, his chest measurement wasn't large enough. You had to be able to, you know, have a certain girth around the chest for the army to accept you.
You had to be this high to enroll.
You had to be a certain height. And so anyhow, he went back home, and in the few months that would pass before his 18th birthday, when he would be able to legally enlist, he subjected himself to a really rigorous exercise program
mm-hmm.
to build up his chest mm-hmm. so that once he turned 18, when he went back again to enlist, he would be able to flex those pectoral muscles and, and you know, stretch the measuring tape and join the army. And he was successful. He got in.
Mm-hmm. But he made it home again. That's why
he was one of the ones who came home again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another person who has a very interesting story was Herbert Philp. That's P-H-I-L-P. He was a journalist, but he did not go over as a war correspondent. He went as a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote home. All of the soldiers wrote letters home, but he looked at things with a journalist's eye, and he wrote letters home that were, amazing accounts of what he saw. He would send them to his parents, and his parents, like many other parents at that time, would give the soldiers letters to the Mercury to publish.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mercury published them under a feature called From the Firing Line.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to see lots of different soldiers' letters, and Herb Philp's are by far the best. Very well written, very, very observant person. Now, he survived the war, but his health was so broken that by the time he came home, I mean, he was like a shell of his former self. He was given a job as an editor at the Mercury, but within, I think, like a year of getting home, he died. So he died as a result of war service, so his name is on the cenotaph, and he is buried in Woodlawn Cemetery.
I think that's one of the more striking things about that war, is that if you survived the front line, it still followed many of veterans home, and whether it was like the mustard gas, the complications from that, or other, lung, bronchial diseases, or, you know, having lost a limb, or mental issues as well. Nobody understood the mental effects of combat. That is still a fairly new frontier in psychology.
Yeah, and at that time, they called it shell shock.
Right.
And it was not, if a soldier was suffering from shell shock, the chances are that the officers would say, "Oh, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just a coward."
Right.
Men came home with emotional damage that I'm sure must have plagued them for all their lives. And there were quite a few men who came home, they might have survived the trenches, but their health was so ruined that they didn't live for very long.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like they died there anyway.
Yeah, well, I guess the difference was they got to be buried at home.
Yeah. Not much of a consolation. But in terms of this research you've done and sort of spending time with these men, you know, 100 years after the fact, is there something that connects them? Do they have sort of traits in common? Have you noticed any kind of patterns like that?
Oh, they were all very different. I mean, you can see some things that they had in common in that they went to the same schools, or they might have worked at the same factory or something. Many of them, they joined up because there was at first a great sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were gonna join the army and go overseas and beat the Hun and it was going to be there was a sense of adventure about it. One of the things that I have taken from it is that when I look at the addresses of where they lived and where they worked, I mean, from the older part of Guelph,
mm-hmm.
you can walk around or drive around the very same streets that these guys knew.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that, you know, I'm sure that the numbers on a lot of the houses must have changed in that time. But, I mean, some of those older houses, those are the houses where they lived.
Yeah.
And when you read about them, you know, things that went on downtown, the parades and all that sort of thing, you know, you can go and stand there on a street corner or stand in St. George's Square and close your eyes and imagine, you know, this is where it happened.
Yeah.
There was one young man who had been wounded over there. He was sent back here, and he was, the army wanted him to act as a recruiter. So there was a recruiting office downtown. I'm not sure exactly where it was. But he would stand out front, and he would buttonhole young men walking by who were not in uniform. You know, stop them and say, "Hey there, you, why aren't you in a uniform? Your pals are overseas fighting. What's the matter with you?"
The thing I think we take away from this now versus Remembrance Days, at least when I was still growing up, was that this is truly history now. There's no one left who remembers being there in the trenches or, you know, fighting in the air, fighting at sea. This is true history, and that we only see it through the lens of what has been written or what has been filmed and what the photographs.
Yeah, and occasionally there are still a few people who are the, you know, the sons or nieces or nephews or daughters of people who served. I got to speak to a few seniors whose fathers or uncles were the ones who were over there, and I mean they had some interesting stories. One lady told me the story that she had from her mother. Now, her father had been killed over there,
mm-hmm.
and she still had the telegram that the family received from the government informing them that the man had been killed. And these telegrams, I mean, that's what happened. There would be a knock at the door, or you would open it, and the telegram would be there.
Mm.
Telegram boy would be there, and he would give you the message. And she said it got to the point where people were afraid. They lived in dread of that knock at the door.
Right.
So if you were going over to visit your neighbor, and it was a neighbor who had somebody overseas, you didn't want to unnecessarily alarm them by knocking on the door.
Mm-hmm.
So you would just go over and yell, "Hey, it's me, anybody home?" Something like that. Because if you knocked at the door, the very first thing that people inside here think is, "Oh no, the telegram."
Yeah. Wow. I love little stories like that because it really paints a picture of what it was like at the time for those people.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that I never even would have thought of myself had she not told me about it.
Exactly. Well, good on you, Ed, for collecting all these stories. And I know there are many more just like them. And so I do hope we see that book someday. And not to put any undue pressure on you, of course. I know you're a busy man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm working on it.
Well, we'll keep up the good work, and thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much for asking me. It's been a pleasure.
And once again, that was author and historian Ed Butts. He will be giving a talk called History Lives Here, Guelph's Cenotaph and the Great War at the Main Library on 100 Norfolk Street at 2 p.m. on Sunday, November 13th. His articles about local history also appear monthly in the Guelph Tribune, so be on the lookout for those as well. And that's all for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. There is also the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph, and of course you can donate to the Guelph Politico Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating, and thank you to everyone who does donate to Guelph Politico and continues to donate, especially during this busy budget season. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.